Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
Well, hello, everybody. This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. And this is show number 117, and it is June 13th, 2022. I'm your host, Tom Riddell, and co-host Terry Brown will be here with us shortly. And a brief intro to today's show, we're having author Nancy McLaughlin on, and she's going to be talking about her life as a writer and her novel, American Nomads. Now, more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell.net. In the blog section and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at tomriddell56. And our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. A special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike. And I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge on June 27th, we will have Richard Bell here with his book, Life Seemed Good, But. These interesting, funny, quirky parodies of life are far beyond strange. They stretch our imaginations into the outrageously bizarre. And on July 11th, 2022, Chris Redwine will be here with his book, The Legend of Lilia. It's the story of Lilia Litviak, who at 15 made her first solo flight in a wooden canvas biplane. By the age of 21, she was the most dangerous woman in the sky as an ace fighter pilot over the Eastern Front of World War II. So that's it for the next several shows, and hope you'll tune in to these very exciting upcoming shows. And now it is my pleasure to introduce, I suppose we should be introducing her as the amazing Terry, or maybe we changed that, I'm not too sure, but she is amazing, and she wrote Sunflowers Beneath the Snow. And I hope you will, if you get a chance, go out there and take a look at that read. It's a very well-written book, and it's very topical to the times that we're living in. So go ahead and do that. And now let me just push the magic button and bring Terry on to the Writer's Lounge. And Terry, are you there?
I am, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. And you said that you would like to talk about researching historical fiction, which I found very exciting because I've always wanted to talk about that with somebody since I wrote a historical fiction. And I think it can really change your whole novel, or it can push you to write another one. What do you think?
Yeah, it can. Yeah. No, I think that, you know, you think you've got this idea and, you know, you're going to go back in time and it's just going to be so simple and you're just going to, you know, write about some other time period. But then, you know, you go to do it and you realize, whoa, I don't even know, did that exist then? The number of times where I had to look up things and say, well, did that even exist? Or when did that phrase come about? Can I use that phrase? You know, you have to do a lot of research to make sure that you're authentic.
Right.
Which is something I feel very strongly about, being as authentic as possible if you're doing historical fiction. Some writers don't feel as strongly, but my feeling is, you know, the only thing that should be made up is the parts that your fake characters are doing.
Right.
But in terms of the history.
Thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of the history, you know, what's happening in that time period, in that area of the world, I think should be just as historically accurate as possible.
I think it's interesting with the book that I wrote. It was about 1920s in the Prohibition era in New York City. And you reminded me of the problem that I had in the story, and I forgot how I rectified it or even if I did, but there was a scene where there was two Prohibition agents standing next to an old car talking to one another, and they were talking about the beer that was being poured down the drains, and they were saying how wonderful it would be to go and have a cold beer. And I began to think about that. Wait a minute. Could they have a cold beer? Did they have ice boxes back then? How did they get the ice in? It was a much different time than we're all
exactly
living in now. So you take those things for granted, but it can throw your whole story off.
When you have those little tiny things like that and you're wrong, I think it can pull the reader completely out of the story. You know, you're going along and, you know, let's you know, put us in World War II era, and you're going along and you say something about a cassette player. Well, you know, those didn't belong there. And immediately your reader is like jerked
right,
completely out of wherever they were. And it doesn't even have to be that big. It can be something really, really small. But if the reader recognizes that it doesn't belong there, it's almost like being slapped. You know, and then it's hard to get back into the story again because now you're wondering what else isn't going to be correct.
What also reminds me to think about what you're saying is, after you're done with your draft and you hand it to your editor, would your editor know to look for those certain circumstances in a historical novel? Because you kind of trust your editor, right?
You do. But on the other hand, you know, you're hoping that your editor would know, but what if they don't? What if they assume that you're the one that knew? So I try to do as much of that myself as possible. And if I have a question that I truly am not sure if this can go in here, then I'll highlight it. And when I send it to my editor, there'll be a note that says, you know, I need second pair of eyes on this. I'm not sure that it can happen this way.
Yeah, I wonder if there's any such... Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. No, that's all right.
I'm just wondering if there's any such thing as a historical fiction editor.
I am sure that there are editors out there who are... That's their genre. That's their thing. with Atmosphere Press, I get an editor, and I do believe that I get an editor that, you know, has done historical fiction, but I don't know that it's that's their only niche. And so I suspect maybe if you're going to be in an era that is particularly tricky, that maybe finding a niche editor that can help you go through and catch those things wouldn't be a bad idea.
Yeah, and it'll give us a chance, and this is pretty much time where we should put in a plug for your for Atmospheric. Is it Atmospheric Press or Atmosphere Press?
No, just Atmosphere. Just Atmosphere,
Atmosphere Press. And they'll be coming on the Blog Talk Radio show, The Writer's Lounge, on July 25th, and maybe we can ask them a little bit more about what they do in regards to something like that, like a historical fiction novel, if they really get into the deep of it, like we were just mentioning. But I do find it extremely interesting in the aspect that I mentioned at the beginning, was how you're going into this research, researching a story like I did with my, you know, my grandfather back in the 1920s, and then going off on a tangent into something totally either unrelated or related and thinking, my God, this would make a better story if I went this direction. And then so now you start taking notes.
Sometimes, right, those pieces of information that you get help you to think, wait a minute, oh, I could go this way, or oh, I could go that way. I have an idea for a book. I'm going on a writer's retreat in a couple of weeks, and I have this idea, and it is about a woman who does healing, lives in the mountains of North Carolina back in the 1890s, somewhere in that era. And I was reading an article the other day about Florence Nightingale, and I started thinking, I wonder, they would be contemporaries. I wonder if I could bring in anything from her. I wonder how I could do that. So, yeah, it's amazing how tidbits will start making your mind run one way or the other as to, like, well, could that even work? And could you put that together? Or would this be a better story? Or you thought you had a way of getting from point A to point B, and then you find out that, well, that would be really great, except that they hadn't invented that yet. So now you have to come up with a whole nother plot.
How fascinating would be that story that you just mentioned, how that exciting it would be to write something like that or to read something like that. I'm just so fascinated with history that I just love it. Another aspect of my novel involved the inventor in that time and that place where my grandfather was actually arrested and put into a little tiny jail. We actually went there and visited the stone jail where he was at, and it just blew me away. I couldn't believe it, but it opens up a whole new world to you, and being able to be a writer, or at least aspiring to be a good writer, really kind of fuels that desire to sit down and do it. Because if you're going to write something, they say write what you know, but sometimes writing what you don't know is just as interesting and exciting, and that's where we jump to when we go into our research, and I just love that part.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think the idea of writing what you know makes sense to a degree, but I had someone ask me, well, you knew nothing about Ukraine. Why would you write about Ukraine? And my answer is, but I know people. And what I really wrote was about people living
right.
in Ukraine. And
right.
I can do the research about the in Ukraine part. So, you know, yes, you should write what you know, but I don't think that that should limit you to say, well, I don't know anything about 1890s in the North Carolina mountains, so I can't write a story there. I think
yeah.
that's what research is for.
And that adds a lot of credit to your credibility in that novel that you wrote, because anybody that would read Sunflowers Beneath the Snow would be certain that the author would know a lot about Ukraine. And I certainly did before I actually had a chance to actually sit down and meet with you. It was an amazing tale that you did. And to think that we can do that, you can do that if you just set your mind to it. You can go into another world and you can learn about this other world and its people and put out something that's, well, it's authentic. It really is, if you have done your homework and did your research the way it should have been done. But anyways, I could go on and on about this topic. Maybe we will have to talk a little bit more when we get off the air at some point. We could discuss this because it really fascinates me. And that story you were mentioning would be a great story, I think. But anyways, the main event today that we're here for is guest author in the interview, and that would be with Nancy McLaughlin, and she wrote American Nomads. Excuse me. And I want to remind everybody, if you're listening live out there, of course, you're, as we say, you're not dead, you're live. So I'm sure everybody out there is listening in. They're listening live right now. And you can give us a call and talk to Nancy and ask her questions and comments to both us, too, would be willing to take those. But you can call us at 914-219-0868. And the book, American Nomads, here's my review of American Nomads. There are nomads, a roaming group of young adults inspired by living life without jobs and the absence of four walls of a house to constrain them. They travel by hopping trains, and they sustain themselves by stealing and socializing with other bands of traveling vagabonds who have also chosen a life of limitless freedom and adventure. Beth, a typical teenager in a middle-class town, meets up with River, a drifter in a small group of traveling misfits, and a bond is formed. River is beautiful, outgoing, and confident, all the things that Beth aspires to be. River soon introduces Beth to her traveling family and friends. Zach the protector, Cash the likable con man, Finn the feral and mistrusting one, and Teague, thoughtful and calm with a funny Cajun accent. A partner to Finn, he tries his best to keep Finn in check and to bring out the best in him. Beth is excited to hear the stories they tell her, and when they offer for her to join them, she doesn't hesitate. She learns the fun and dangers of hopping a train, camps out under the stars, and soon she is sharing her nomad experiences with her online friends, and immediately her posts go viral. But not all is fun and wonderful. When behaviors of a few of her companions turn to a dark and disturbing side, she wonders if she made a horrible mistake. What will Beth do? With her safety at stake, will she continue to follow along with these people? Or will she go back to her old life? I read and review many books over the course of a year, and it is not often that I come across a story that focuses on this mostly unknown segment of our population. I find the lives of these people very interesting, and I crave to learn more. In this respect, the author has delivered beyond what I could have imagined. Although this is a work of fiction, the characters are rich and absorbing, and it's hard to believe they don't actually exist. Many readers, editors, and publishers have said that the characters steer a story and make or break a book. American Nomad should serve to define what good character development is all about. Hands down, one of the best and most memorable character-driven stories I have ever read. I look forward to reading more in this series. American Nomads is a must-read. And now it is my pleasure, along with Terry, to welcome Nancy McLaughlin to the Writer's Lounge broadcast, and she should be right about...
I'm here.
Oh, boy, there she is. She jumped right in there. How you doing, Nancy?
Pretty good, pretty good. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. Where are you calling from?
Texas, North Texas.
Ah, warm down there?
A little bit. Been triple digits, which I actually kind of like, so it works for me. Not for everybody around me, but I'm happy.
Right, kind of the dry heat, right?
No, it's a little bit more humid. South Texas is more dry, but this is a little more humid. But by no means is it like Houston humid, but it's humid.
After doing a little research on you, I found out that you served our country in the Marines, and you weren't exactly a nomad to these United States, but you certainly found your way around several of them. How did you get your start in your writing career, and how has your life experiences influenced American Nomads?
You know, I've always read since I was a small child. Reading was a big deal for me because I was sick. So staying inside, reading, it was just books were my world. And I always wanted to write. Let's see. When I got out of the Marine Corps and I went to college, I intended to study journalism, which is what I did. So my background in writing was more journalistic. I don't know. This story, just these characters just kind of stuck around in my head for a couple of decades. So, you know, I had a bunch of free time and I just sat down and kind of penned out a basic story on them. I'm thankful for editors that worked with me because I had to relearn how to write. My writing style was, you know, I learned to write journalistically, and that's a completely different world than creative writing.
Interesting that you say that, because I started out writing nonfiction small business articles, and mm-hmm. that too is very different from creative writing. You know, there's certain rules that you have to follow that aren't true in the fiction side of the world. So, yeah, it can be kind of tough making that switch.
Yes, it was interesting. You know, my editor was very good about working with me on that because, you know, when you're writing journalistically or you're writing nonfiction, you have to stick to details. You don't embellish, and your writing is very concise. So needless to say, the original versions of the book were very different than what the finished product is.
Yeah, and I would say that you and Terry have something in common, as you're both character-driven in your stories, or at least that was my take from your book, Nancy, because as I wrote in my review, your characters just popped off the page. Just loved them, and I could hardly believe that they're fictional. I thought they were real. It was so well written.
That's awesome to hear. I've actually heard from a number of people who will have from one time or another would be, you know, I just can't believe these people aren't real. It's I think that's great because to me they've, like I said, they've been in my head for so long.
They are real to you.
They almost are.
And Terry, you had taken a bike trip across the United States. I don't know if Nancy knows that, but I was thinking about you when I was reading the review, and you must have run into...
We were a little nomadic for a couple of months there.
Yeah. Did you run into any people like that, that were jumping trains and just hanging out? I'm sure you probably met or came across some homeless people, right?
Yeah, we definitely did. We met a wide variety of people. When you're out on the road like we are going 10 miles an hour, you do see a lot. I don't know how many people I met who would truly be homeless or nomadic, but we definitely met a lot of people who I would consider were like more on the fringe of society, you know, not necessarily with a regular job, not necessarily, you know, maybe not homeless, but not necessarily living in one particular place, you know, moving from place to place. We met a lot of characters, without a doubt.
Right. And Nancy, one of the most striking character quotes in your book came from, I believe, Finn. And he gave me time to reflect on a truth that I think we all can agree with. He said, and here's the quote, "You know, there was a time when people didn't live for things like views, followers, shares, upvotes, and likes. They actually lived their lives with close friends and family." Isn't this a great teaching moment, Nancy, for people who may look down on the homeless or who may look down on the nomads who choose to roam the country without the norms of our society? Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I wanted to portray them as realistic as possible. Over the years, I'm kind of the person that will talk to anyone. And over the years, I've met quite a few people that hop trains and that live this sort of nomadic life. And it's interesting how happy, I guess you could say, most of them seem to be. There's a difference, a different air about them. They are doing their own thing. They're living outside of what all of us see. You know, we couldn't imagine living their way because they just kind of move around and they're not tethered or tied to anything. It's a sense of freedom. I don't think a lot of people can wrap their brains around that right now in our day and age that we're in right now with all the technology.
Right, right. Go ahead.
Go on.
I was going to say that also the character's name Finn comes to my mind thinking of Huckleberry Finn. Is that where you derived the name from, or where did you pick that name up from?
Actually, no. He as a character has kind of been in my head for a couple of decades, and it's always been known as Finn. So that to me, that's where his name came from. I wasn't really thinking about that, but that's an awesome connection that I hadn't considered at all. Thank you.
Yeah. Terry.
Yeah. So you were talking that you've met some people who did train hopping. Have you ever done that? Or like what kind of research did you have to do to make that a realistic aspect of this story?
Well, yes, I've spoken to a lot of people who have done it. I've met people from all different ages and that either used to hop trains. I mean, it's during the span of time where I was writing this book, it seemed as though everywhere I would go, if I would run into some random person who literally had hop trains or was hopping trains. It was almost kind of like the world was telling me that it was time to write this book. Their experiences, the stories they shared, they were incredible. They were, you know, they have a kind of a spark in their eyes when they're talking about the things they do and have done. You know, I think the oldest person I met who used to hop trains at one point, he had to be in his late 80s. His name was Michael. He was impressive.
What I also liked about the train hopping was the procedures and how to get on and how to get off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was fascinating.
There's just talking to people who've done it, they'll gladly explain to you how they do it, how they hop on, how they get off, where they do. It's not that difficult to learn about it. I guess it just takes more bravery to give it a try.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's one of those things I bet you can find out a lot about it, but I don't know that I would have ever thought to research that.
Welcome to my
brain. like there's so many things you can just Google just about anything, but I don't know that I would have ever thought, I wonder how you hop on a train.
Yeah.
You know, to me it's fascinating because, you know, just like you said, you know, you wouldn't have even, it's just not something that most people consider. It's just how bizarre that somebody would just randomly think, wow, I think I'm going to hop a train and go somewhere. It's a particular type of person that I find extremely fascinating because they're wanderers. And they,
you know, it's interesting. I would have thought in my mind, I knew people used to hop trains back in the Depression era, but I thought that was all gone. I didn't even know that it really still existed. So I just find that really fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing how much it's changed and hasn't changed. You know, there is modern technology, and thanks to technology, they can use their phones to communicate with one another. I included a lot of that in the book, and they use their phones to, you know, figure out where they are with maps and such. You know, I can't imagine how they got around and knew where they were going before technology, because with technology, they have a lot of help to do what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah, and Beth was instrumental in doing that. She brought the texting and all of the social media into the lives of those other people that were in your story.
Yeah, she did. Beth is kind of just your typical teenager, right? She does everything that they do. She loves being online. She wants to be popular. She wants to be, she's, you know, she's what every average teenager would be like today, no?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Nancy, who was your favorite character to write about in your story and why?
Let's see. That's a hard one right there. They all kind of serve a different purpose. I really, you know, I think one of my favorite ones right now is Zach. You know, he comes a little more into his own in book two. You know, Finn will always be near and dear to me. I kind of put him through the ringer. He's going through a lot, but he's probably, I would say if I had to choose an absolute favorite, it would be Finn out of those characters right now.
Yeah, and
I'm curious, was he the first character?
Yeah, he's sort of he is. He was the first character that came to life in my mind.
Right.
It's funny because Teague was the last character that I created, which is interesting because he's such an integral part to the story.
It's interesting how sometimes characters will do that, where you almost have to create them to help hold the story together. You know, you've got all of
right.
these pieces, and you need that one person who can kind of be that glue. So, yeah, I think that's great.
I should mention here, Nancy, that you do have another book out that's a continuation of the story with Finn in it. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's Lost Boys. It's book two, and it picks up a few months after book one ends.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. It pulls a lot of it. So Daniel's a very big component in book two. And of course, there's more of the nomads and their the way they travel around and their crazy antics that they get into. There's just a lot more of what they were doing, and you know, it has kind of a I believe my editor called it a heartbreaking ending, but you know, it follows along from where they were, and it brings the whole Daniel part into play.
Terry?
So what genre of books do you enjoy reading? And then what are some of your favorite authors?
You know, that's kind of funny because I read a lot of horror, which is interesting because I don't write horror, and I can't write horror. I also like reading some dark fantasy, but again, it's just not something I can write. You know, as far as favorite authors, you know, obviously I love Jack Kerouac. I mean, that was where, you know, my first, I guess you could say, he was back when I was 16 years old and read him. He was the first author I ever read that opened my mind to a whole different way of being, just traveling, just on the road was amazing and life altering, I guess, but I was 16 when I read it the first time. I would say another author that I really like is Chuck Palahniuk. And you know, I think my favorite book from his is Invisible Monsters. You know, so I guess you could say I like reading more gritty, realistic stuff, but I also like horror and dark fantasy, and then I don't even know what genre really my book fits in, but it's there.
It's all good.
It's kind of a mishmash, I guess.
In your comments to readers, you had said, and I quote, "When I first set about committing word to page, I did not know the incredible journey I was about to embark upon. Life is busy, it's messy and uneven and filled with distractions. There were times when I didn't look as though I would ever finish. There were times when I questioned whether I even wanted to. In the process of writing, as we do here on the Writer's Lounge, can you kind of explain a little bit more about that process to us?
Like how I wrote it or just what I meant when I was writing that part?
Well, you know, we all have those times when we don't want to go on or we kind of push a story to the side. What happens in those moments, in those days when that's happening? Do you put it off for a week or do you pick it up in a couple of days? What's it like in your head when you're trying to decide what you're going to write or what you're going to throw away?
Oh, okay. Well, like, first I'll just say, like, when for me, you know, the things that most got in the way is life. You know, I have 6 kids. They're all young adults now. But when you're trying to do one thing and they're growing into the world and you're trying to interact and help them out, they're very time-consuming. So that gets tabled. And then when it started getting a little bit, you know, it just gets a little life circumstances. You have a lot of things that are, you know, kind of weighting you down. One of the last things you want to do is sit down and try to be exact or technical on things when it comes to writing or doing research into something when really all you want to do is just kind of escape. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Terry, okay. Got anything to add to that?
No, other than she has 6. I have 4, and I understand completely that, you know, when you have children, they definitely come first, and they require a lot of time, and there isn't a whole lot left over for writing. And then I can imagine when you said that you weren't sure that you were going to finish or whether you even wanted to, you know, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about, for me, the writing process, the original writing process, I didn't mind at all. I could have done that over and over. It was when I had to do the editing that there are times where I just wanted to take the whole thing and throw it because it was like, this isn't, it's not, for me anyway, it doesn't flow as well. Like when I'm just writing, getting it out of my head, I just write and write and write and it feels fantastic. And then you have to go back and fix it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly it. You know, I leave little codes for me where I'm writing, where I just want to get the idea out of my head. And I put little codes like in my writing. So all of a sudden I'll come across one of them and it's like, I don't know what I meant here. And because when you're just throwing it down and you're right, it's the going back, trying to be exact, trying to, you know, you got to do a little more research to look into something or just try to figure out how to reword something or more details needed here.
Get your characters so they're not as flat or
yes.
You know, the number of times my editor would say to me, you know, this is great. We have no idea where you are. You have not described the scenery at all. Are you indoors? Are you outdoors? And it's like, who cares? Who cares?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's, you know, it's the going, it is the revisions. That's the hardest part. Yeah. I'm working on book 3 right now and the revisions are killing me. So I'll do anything to avoid it. So.
Yeah. I think your house is spotless right now.
Probably, yeah.
Can you imagine the complications of co-authoring with somebody in regards to what you were both talking about? That's got to just be a nightmare. I can't even imagine doing that.
No, neither can I. In fact, I was talking with someone who was doing a co-author, and it was like, oh, my gosh, I think I'd rather poke my eyes out. Like, it doesn't sound pleasant at all.
I would feel really bad for whoever would want to co-author with me because I end up on tangents and I am the worst person to try to work with on something. So pity anyone who would try.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, how did friends and family receive your book after you first put it out there, after all of that trouble you had?
They've, you know, it's amazing. I have an amazing circle of people around me and, you know, they've all been just blown away by it and enjoyed it. It's funny because we got to learn some things about older family members, like my father-in-law. Apparently he hopped trains when he was younger, and this is a tidbit of his past that never came out till he read my book.
Oh, wow.
I have a friend who, when she read it, she said, "Oh yeah, my husband, her late husband, used to hop trains when he was a teenager." And it's just funny how all little anecdotal stories like that are popping out from people that we've known, that I've known for years or whatever. And just funny because I had no idea so many people did this at one point or another.
Nancy, you had mentioned the second book. Can you tell us a little bit more what that will be about? It's about Teague and Finn, correct?
Well, it's about all of them. We explore River and Cash a little more. Without giving away any major spoilers or anything on it, Zach kind of comes into his own. He's a big character in book two. Beth is still Beth. It's funny because my 18-year-old, she's my youngest, after reading the book, her thing was, just kill Beth. Just shove her off the train. No one will care. It's so funny because I feel so bad for this character because I've heard from so many people. They've told me just drop her off at a bus stop. Just send her home. She needs to be packing. Just the horrible things. I feel so bad for poor Beth. But she's still Beth, and it kind of explores a little more. I don't know if you remember towards the end, Max, Bells, and DB, they show up in book two, the other nomads. They were the ones over the video call. And, you get to know them a lot better and, in all their crazy, weird ways that they do things. And, River and Cash, they kind of grow closer. It dives a little more into the dynamic between those two. And Finn and Teague, yes, there is a, how do I word it? It's building the strife, the friction between the two of them is building because there's only so long that someone or anyone can walk on eggshells for another person, no matter how much they love them. And there's a lot of friction between the two of them, and it builds up. There is a major, major plot twist in book two, and the ending is a double cliffhanger. So there's two different storylines that have to come together in the remaining books.
And thus is book three.
And see, now you get why I'm procrastinating so much on book three. I created this situation where there's this spiderweb mess of things I have to pull together. And, it's just my brain some days. I don't want to do it.
I can understand that. So, I'm curious, do you have any other story ideas in your head besides the American Nomad series?
Oh, my goodness. I have so many. I think the hardest part is putting them all down. I have a number of different ones, different stories that I've drafted out. My husband recently suggested that I get like the Dragon software or some sort of software where I can just talk the story out and it will get it to paper. And then I can go back and do the part we all love, the revisions. but I think that's a great idea. So I'll be looking into that next because there's so many ideas going on. Let's see. My main project I'm working on right now though is, it's more of a fantasy, I guess. It's based around the Celtic gods. And, I seem to have a thing about nomads because one of the main characters is a van lifer.
Wow.
That story interesting.
That is very interesting. What would be the one thing you'd want a reader to come away with after reading your books? And I should also ask you, how many books in the series you expect to put out?
There's four books in the series. I'm not sure if I'll continue in their world because I know how it ends and I There's a lot of opportunity for more stories. There are side stories, origin stories of all the characters that I'm working through and posting and putting those up on my website. And, you know, as those are completed, I guess I might throw them together into a book form, because it shows not just the main characters, but all of the nomads. So it wouldn't just, you know, it's not just the core characters. It's the origin stories of everyone, like Ben, Mara, all of the other characters that are in there in the sides. And there's a lot of different side stories that I could work with, but I'm not really thinking about that part right now. I'm just trying to get through the first four. And what was the other question you asked?
What do you want readers to come away with?
Oh, you know, there's a billion different ways to live life. I mean, there's just billions of ways. And, you know, the trick is finding the one that works best for you. So, you know, some people like to live in a suburban neighborhood. Other people want to live in the city. Other people want to travel around. You know, you've got to figure out how, what's the best way for you to be happy in this life. And I think that's the, you know, and to not be so, you know, look at these people. Everyone has a full story. Everyone has a story behind them. It's amazing when you stop and listen to them.
Yes. And not be so narrow-minded, I would say, too, would be the thing that I would want people to come away after reading your book.
Yes, I absolutely agree. You know, if people could just, I don't know, don't judge. Let people, they're not hurting anyone. They're doing their own thing. Let people live. Let them be happy and find your happiness, you know.
You had mentioned in the beginning about being a journalist. What was that like? What did you write about?
You know, it was what, the early 90s in the Boston area. Just typical whatever story was going on at the time. It was interesting. It was fun. I enjoyed it a lot. But obviously I didn't enjoy it enough to stick with it. So, you know, it was an interesting time.
Did you have to go out and interview a lot of people and interact with a lot of different people, I would imagine?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons I went into it, because, you know, I said earlier, I will talk to anyone. And I've always been the kind of person that I'll wander around and end up in conversations with other people. I love hearing other people's stories. I love listening to the thing, what they're thinking, you know, and sometimes it's a little weird, you know, and other times, you know, it's just fascinating to hear. I will say now, there was a time when I was writing American Nomads, and I had mentioned earlier about the older gentleman that I had met. His name was Michael. It was one of those periods where I kind of didn't really want to work on the book anymore. I was so tired of it. But my son at that time needed a ride to class because he didn't get his ride. So I drove him, and I was like, all right, I'll just go get a coffee and sit down, and maybe a change of scenery will be enough to get me back into writing this book. And when I walked in, I have a few tattoos, and I have that actual compass tattoo on me. They're the Nomad's compass.
Oh, you
and,
do?
Oh yeah. There was this group of older veterans that were having coffee in the coffee shop, and one of them came up to me and asked me, "Oh, were you in the Navy?" I was like, "No, I wasn't."
Uh-huh.
So I got my coffee. The conversation ended there, and I went outside. And as I was sitting at the table with my laptop open, one of the men from the table, he walked out and made a phone call. And then he saw me sitting at the computer, and he stopped, and he's like, "Hey, what are you working on?" And I told him I'm writing a book. And he said, "Really? Uh-huh. What's the book about?" And I said, "Oh, it's about a bunch of train hopping, you know, people that are train hopping across the U.S., And the funniest thing, his face lit up, and he quoted Kerouac to me. It was the most
really?
Weird
wow.
moment. And I kind of looked at him, and I'm thinking in my head that this that this old man really just quote Kerouac to me. So now I'm intrigued.
Wow.
And so I told him, I said, well, it sounds like you know what you're talking about. And he smiled and he pulled up a chair and he said, you know, and he told me the story about a young man home from the Korean War who was in New York working off the docks. And another young man had recently published a book that he was reading, that he loved the book. He loved the story and always wondered about doing that. And it just so happened that this hobo showed up at the docks, and all the other people at the docks were like, don't feed him, you know, treat him like a stray animal. He'll go away. But Michael shared his lunch with him. And over a span of 2 weeks, he got to know this guy. And, you know, sure enough, he quit his job and he hopped trains. He always wanted to go down to Galveston. So they hopped trains from New York to Houston. And wow. And hitchhiked the rest of the way to Galveston, where they spent a couple of weeks on the beach. And then he spent a few months after that hopping trains until he finally went back to New York. I was blown away. It was, you know.
That's amazing.
Isn't it crazy how you meet people who just, like, they help you push the story along, or they give you that inspiration, or you know, can even provide some insights so that your characters have a more full experience. I love that.
Yeah, that. I mean, like I said, that's what this was all about. There was, you know, that's what was happening throughout the whole time I was writing this book. It was almost like at certain periods of time when I kind of was at my least, my lowest level of wanting to continue working on this project, I would just randomly run into somebody and they would share these amazing stories. And I was like, all right, I got to keep going. So, I mean, it's just kind of blows me away how, when I
right.
think about it, how
right.
there were a lot of
certain,
things pushing it.
Got to be a certain vibe about meeting somebody as a journalist or even as a novelist who is, you know, writing a book and someone comes up to you, like you just explained. But mm-hmm. I think it's interesting and exciting that you've got that kind of that fountain that kind of just starts and people start talking and everything starts coming out of it. It's almost magical when it starts to happen, but then there's the other mm-hmm. side of it when people don't want to tell you any stories that you'd like to hear from. And that's powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it is awesome when like I said, I love talking to people. I will talk to anyone, you know, and I love hearing their stories and, you know, their thoughts. It's just fascinating to me. It always has been.
Yeah. Terry?
Let's see here. I'm curious about this. Where do you like to write?
Well, I like to write in my sunroom. Now, let's see. I wrote everywhere. When I will write anywhere. Now, the kids were younger, and I had two younger ones, and so with American Nomads, I wrote that in my car. I wrote it on park benches, at coffee shops. I even went and had a couple of beers sitting there writing to finish the story. I'll pretty much write anywhere if I'm ready to write. I'm not one of those people that can set a time to write every day, because that just never seems to work for me.
It doesn't work for me either. I hate it.
Oh, I've
tried it. It's awful. It's like torture. I can't stand it.
Yes. You're at the desk going, okay, I'm sitting here. I'm ready to write. What are words? I mean, you just can't, I can't put anything together that way. So, you know, I think my favorite place to write is outside.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anywhere outside, you know, especially when it's really hot out, like right now. I just like being outside and the heat and the sun, and that just to me is the best writing place.
Wow.
I like to write anywhere but in my office.
Isn't that right?
when I'm in my office, I sit down and it's like, oh, why can't I write here? And it's crazy because my office is yellow, which I love. And it has pictures of the beach, which I love. And everything about this office was made because I love it, and then I write anywhere else. So I have no idea what my problem
is. That's great.
Very great. Well, Nancy, we've got a little less than 5 minutes left, and we usually call this your Oscar moment. Any parting words that you'd like to share, and would you like to thank anyone out there?
You know, you've read the book, so the opening, you know, but the single most amazing person that helped push me through this, a lot of it to get this done, is my husband, Robert. You know, we met in the Marine Corps years ago. We've been a part of each other's lives longer than we were without each other. And he's my road trip partner. He's the person that when I really didn't want to write, he would bug me till I did. I think that's, you know, and my kids, they drive me crazy, but they're an endless source of information as far as younger people and the way they think and interact. So, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. I would say those are the people that do the most for me right now with the writing, aside
yeah, even
from random
when,
people I run into.
Yeah, even when they want to kill off a character.
she's invested. She's actually starting to write her own story, so I'm excited about that.
That's great. Nancy, it's been fun. Terry, I think you would agree. We had a great time.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of fun. I'm sure you two can get together and share notes on your process of writing. I think you guys would get along really well. So thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge, Nancy.
Thanks for having me. It's been a joy.
Okay. And there goes Nancy and her book, American Nomads. You can find it out there at your best booksellers that are out there online, Amazon and other such sites too. And so any parting words from you, Terry?
No, although I really do. I'm going to have to connect with Nancy and make sure that we chat, because I think she and I have a very similar writing style, which is write when you're ready and don't when you're not, and don't let anyone force you into an office and make you write for an hour every morning. So,
yeah. See, I can't leave my office. It's the only place where I can write is my office, which is where I am right now. Yeah, it is. It's very interesting, and it's fun. I like to hear about the people that are in the coffee shops that do their writing from coffee shops, because they're connected to people in those coffee shops, and I find that fascinating. So.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite places is out on the beach. I love to sit on the beach and write.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yes. So. We're going to talk to you in 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks,
yep.
On June 27th, 2022, Richard Bell will be here. Life Seemed Good, But these interesting, funny, quirky parodies of life are far beyond strange. They stretch our imaginations into the outrageously bizarre, and I do mean outrageously bizarre, and very funny. So I can't wait to hear from Richard Bell on that. Until then, Terry and I, we'll see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and the eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves, be well, and good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make